ladies and gentlemen. First case for argument today is United States versus Whiting Paper Company. Mr. Freed.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is an appeal from a de minimis settlement under 122G of CERCLA, which provides that there may be a de minimis settlement if the amounts contributed by the settling parties are minimal in comparison to the hazardous materials at the facility. This is part of the enormous $1.5 billion cleanup of PCBs in the Lower Fox River. The appellants, NCR and API, are associated with the manufacture of carbonless copy paper, and in the manufacture of carbonless copy paper, there is one particular kind of PCB, Araclor 1242, which is used, as in every other badly polluted river. There are all kinds of PCBs in the river. Araclor 1242 is one of them. This settlement is, in the canonical words of review for such settlement agreements, unfair, unreasonable, and inconsistent with the purposes of CERCLA. And the embodiment of the settlement in a consent decree is an abuse of discretion. The criteria for abuse of discretion in a case like this were set out and repeated endlessly in the First Circuit's Cannon's engineering case. Has a material factor been ignored? Has an improper factor been relied upon? Has there been a serious mistake in weighing them? All three are present in this case. The government and the trial court, who have managed this case throughout, have put the whole onus of the cleanup on the appellants. They have already spent something like $250 million in this cleanup, and they are currently working. They are the only ones who are currently working. To reject this settlement agreement will not delay the work that is going on, and certainly will not provide funds for the continuation of the work. The government has sought at every turn to block the appellant's attempt to get a fair attribution of responsibility in this case. They have sought contribution. That decision has been delayed and delayed and delayed. The appellants have sought a 54B to bring it before this court, along with the present appeal. That 54B has been languishing for over a year. The trial court, at the instance of the government, has entered a case management order which has precluded appellants from engaging in discovery which would establish the proper apportionment of responsibility in this case. And the trial court has denied the appellant's request that the question of divisibility under Burlington Northern be decided prior to the allocation of responsibility implicit in this settlement agreement. Again, that adjudication of joint and several liability or several liability would not delay the cleanup and would certainly not provide funds for the creation, for the continuation of the cleanup. Now, why do I say that material facts have been ignored, improper factors relied on, serious mistakes made in weighing them. First, the government itself concedes in its brief that non-1242 arachlors, that is to say, PCBs with which the appellants have had nothing to do, represent approximately 5% of the PCBs in the river. Now, as my colleague, Ms. Roach, will point out, that is a gross underestimate. But in any event, 5% of $1.5 billion is $75 million. This settlement is $2.2 million, or 0.15%. In addition to that, the court below relied on a palpably improper factor in reaching its conclusion that this is a proper settlement. It incorporated by reference and explicitly its decision in the contribution case that the comparative fault, the comparative culpability, who knew what and when about the toxicity of these PCBs, weighed very heavily against the appellants. Now, under 122G, comparative culpability is not a proper factor. It is not a factor to be considered at all. 122G asks only the comparable contributions of pollutants to the facility. These equitable factors weigh in contribution actions. They have nothing to do with the entrance of a consent decree in a settlement, and yet the district court invoked that, and therefore, in the words of Canons Engineering, relied upon an improper factor. Moreover, this culpability factor, in addition to being improper, is illogical, because who knew what and when about 1242s says nothing about who knew what and when about the many other PCBs.
Well, isn't it pretty clear, though, that it's the 1242 air chlorers that are the very major bulk of the pollution?
They are a major bulk. That is quite clear. However,
And your clients were emitting tremendous volumes of those over the decades that this went on.
Large volumes were associated with carbonless copy paper. That's true. We do not agree that they were emitting all of those 1242s. That is a subject. Indeed, that would be a subject that for the divisibility argument which we've tried to make. But in any event, a large proportion is very different from 0.15%, particularly when the government itself cites a study which we think is inaccurate, that 5% or $70 million is the non-1242 arachlors. That's why we say the settlement is improper. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Freed. Mr. Roach?
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. In order to meet the requirements of Section 122G, which requires a comparison of, on the one hand, the hazardous substances contributed by the settling parties, and on the other hand, the other hazardous substances at the facility, the government was required to do two things. First, determine the amount of hazardous substances contributed by the settling parties, and two, to determine the total amount of hazardous substances in the river. The government did neither one of those things, and the district court then improperly rubber-stamped the settlements with effectively no review. With respect to the first point, the amount of hazardous substances contributed by the settling defendants. The government put out some very specific sounding estimates, but the government failed to submit anything in particular in support of these estimates. There's no affidavit from the EPA or any outside expert explaining how the numbers were arrived at. There's no witness testimony, no documentary references, no calculations. The government hasn't even identified who it was that conjured up these estimates. For all the record reveals, these numbers could have been pulled out of thin air by one of the lawyers from the Department of Justice. The case law requires that the figures must derive in a sensible way from a plausible interpretation of the record. There was nothing in what was submitted by the government to the district court that showed the work in terms of how these estimates were derived at. But that didn't trouble the district court, which simply accepted the government's estimates at face value. The district court specifically held that the estimates were, quote, fair and reasonable. But the court gave no indication as to how it could possibly so conclude in the absence of any evidence as to how these estimates were derived. Instead, the district court references its own view that appellants are more culpable than the settlers. Appellants strongly disagree with that conclusion, but more to the point for this appeal, as Mr. Fried pointed out, Section 122G says nothing about this relative culpability that the district court went to instead of doing what it was supposed to do, which is make sure that the numbers, the estimates provided by the government were derived in a sensible way from a plausible interpretation of the record. And we believe the district court abused its discretion by approving the consent decrees on the basis of an improper factor not identified in the statute and in the absence of any evidence that supports the government's estimate of the settlers' contribution.
You've got some problem with the portion of the consent decree that allows the government to go back should it later be determined that the settlers' portion was greater than estimated by the consent decree. Who should it be if not the government that makes that determination?
In terms of to trigger the reopener?
Right.
Our problem is not necessarily with the fact that the government triggers the reopener. It's the fact that the statute's requirements were not complied with in the first instance. And we don't believe that the reopener satisfies our concerns in any way because only the government can utilize it. There won't be an opportunity to take the discovery necessary to disprove the government's estimates. And the government, frankly, is the very party that rushed to judgment here in the first place and ignored what we think is potentially significant additional liability that the settlers have. And the government has no interest in pursuing the others since API and NCR are currently funding the cleanup. With respect to the second half of the equation, the total amount of hazardous substances in the river, the government again failed to meet its burden, and the district court again improperly accepted the government's numbers at face value. The government targeted AirClor 1242 exclusively from the very beginning of its investigation, modifying its own testing methods to omit detects of non-1242. It failed to investigate potential dischargers of non-1242. It didn't even issue information requests to a number of the settling defendants who are not in the paper industry. And it is actually not at all clear that most of the PCBs in the river are 1242 associated with carbonless copy paper. The government claims and cites one article in support of its position that 95% of the PCBs in the river are from AirClor 1242. That article actually does not say that. It's not nearly that definitive. The authors looked at several different models for analyzing the very limited data that they looked at. One of those models actually showed as much as 20% of the PCBs in the river could be AirClor 1248. And what appellants put into the record is a much more extensive study by a company called ATS, which looked at 7,000 sediment samples and concluded that as much as 34% of the PCBs in the river could be comprised of non-1242. Moreover, there's substantial evidence that non-1242 was discharged by the very settling defendants who were able to settle out their liability for a collective 0.15% share of what could be a $1.5 billion cleanup here. The government actually admits five of the settling parties have never been associated with carbonless copy paper, and their liability rests solely on discharges of PCBs from other sources. Three others themselves purchased PCBs directly from the manufacturer and clearly then used PCBs for purposes unrelated to carbonless copy paper. The government purports to have taken the non-1242 discharges of the settlers into account in its estimates, but again, it never discloses how. It doesn't show its work, and because the government admits that rather than looking at the total amount of hazardous substances in the river, it looked solely at 1242 and used it as a proxy for all of the PCBs, we are left, and the district court was left, with a complete inability to tell how the non-1242 concededly discharged by the settling defendants was taken into account, if at all, by the government.
Well, can it be done with that kind of precision that you're talking about? The ARCLORs, don't they degrade over time? We're talking about 50 years or more of pollution. And trying to put this all back together is a little like Humpty Dumpty, isn't it?
Not completely. There have been, as I said, the ATS report, which is part of the record, which was submitted by appellants, went through 7,000 sediment samples and was able to make a determination as to the relative contribution of 1242 versus non-1242. And we are, contrary to what the government said, we are not asking for exact precision. What we are asking for is that the requirements of the statute be complied with, that there be that the estimates be rational and be rationally based on a plausible interpretation of the record. And that simply hasn't been done.
But the government gets a pretty wide berth, pretty wide leeway, doesn't it, in focusing on problems like this because of the reasons that it's so difficult to put Humpty Dumpty back together.
Well, the government does get deference under the case law, but as the Ninth Circuit said in Montrose Chemical, deference does not mean turning a blind eye to an empty record on a critical aspect of settlement evaluation. And that's what happened here with respect to both parts of the equation, both how much the settling defendants contributed as well as the total amount of hazardous substances in the river. The district court accepts the government's representation as to the latter at face value, stating in its opinion that, well, the agencies are allowed to focus on any toxin that they want to. This is another misreading of CERCLA. Section 122G doesn't say the government can look at whatever toxin they want to in isolation. Section 122G requires a comparison of the amount of settlers' contribution with the amount of other hazardous substances at the site, not just the one substance that the governments want to focus on. And I see that the light is on, and I will reserve the rest of my time for my rebuttal.
Mr. Piet.
Good morning, and may it please the Court, Justin Pedell for the United States. I wanted to begin this morning, I think, with talking about the history of both the Fox River and the litigation that's gone on, because I think the government has some disagreements with the appellants here about what has unfolded. Over the last decades, the government has, and both governments, and I should note, I have Cynthia Hirsch from from Wisconsin with me at counsel table, and Jeff Spector, who's also with the Department of Justice. So the governments, and I'm referring to Wisconsin and the United States when I say that, have compiled extensive amounts of information about the Fox River. We've been involved in this site for decades, and indeed, the 104E request, and that's a request that the government issues to collect information that is in the record, I believe it was in docket entry 43, that was issued in 1997, asks for information about all releases of hazardous substances, not just AERCLOR 1242. It emphasizes PCBs, but it does not specify. It is only looking for information about AERCLOR 1242. And in response to those information requests, in response to talking with the people who were on the river, with the response to talking to NCR and Appleton about any information they have may have about other parties who have released PCBs, the government discovered at an early time that the Fox River is that most of the evidence of releases of PCBs relate to NCR paper and take the form of Aerochlor 1242. Now, that really shouldn't be surprising. It's true that as the briefs suggest, NCR's briefs suggest, there are lots of other ways that PCBs are used, and there's a lot of urbanization in the country, and PCBs are used in a variety of places. However, virtually no river is as contaminated as the Fox River. And what's different about the Fox River than all of the other rivers in this country where you have public utilities that operate near the river, for instance, which is some of the settling parties here? What's different is that NCR paper was made there. And why is that important? Because NCR paper is impregnated with PCBs. So we have an industrial process that we know released hundreds of thousands of kilograms of PCBs into the water, and we have an intense degree of contamination in the water. It doesn't take a great leap of inference to believe that that is a primary source of the PCBs, particularly where you've done all these other investigations and you've turned up no evidence for substantial other sources. There is no evidence, for instance, of one of the settlers driving a truck full of PCBs to the river in the dead of night and emptying it into the water. And that's really what it would take, some evidence of some other source of PCBs, for the government's approach to be unreasonable. I also want to focus on some things that Mr. Freed suggested.
You've already reached some agreement regarding, isn't it OU1, is that how it's designated?
That's correct. The
mouth of the river, the first part.
I think OU1 is actually the most upriver portion.
Upriver. And that's not part of this disagreement, is it?
No, that's correct. There are other PRPs who we entered a consent decree with who are cleaning up that portion of the river. And it is a point I wanted to make, because I don't think it's fair to suggest that the government is looking only to appellants here in terms of the cleanup. First, because of OU1, as you correctly point out, Your Honor, that is a portion of the river that's being cleaned up by other PRPs. And moreover, the unilateral administrative order that led to the cleanup that's at issue here was not issued just to NCR and Appleton. The government issued that unilateral administrative order to 8 PRPs that it believed were primarily responsible. The fact that as a matter of their own private arrangements, NCR and Appleton have decided that they're going to fund the cleanup and sue the others in contribution, that isn't something that the government participated. We didn't say Appleton and NCR need to pay for this. Other 6 of you sit out. We said all 8 of you. You are jointly responsible for cleaning it up. Clean it up. I'll beg your pardon for mentioning something that's happened after briefing, but we have filed suit against 14 parties on the river as of middle of October, and we amended our complaint just last month.
Are those 14 involved in the contribution suit that NCR Appleton has?
They are, and NCR and Appleton are 2 of those PRPs, but there are 12 other PRPs that the United States has filed a 106 and 107 suit against, because we believe that those 14 are much more substantial contributors of PCBs than, for instance, the de minimis parties. The parties that are at issue here are the parties where there is virtually no evidence of PCB releases. If you look at the ATS study, which NCR relies on very heavily, in an index to that, ATS identifies all of the evidence that it has compiled of PCB releases by these parties, by these settling parties. And if you look through that, the evidence is incredibly scant. Union Pacific Railroad, for instance. ATS says, well, railroads have been known to discharge PCBs in other places. So we think Union Pacific did too. With respect to Neenah Foundry, ATS says, well, there's an estimate that Neenah Foundry releases 0.0007 pounds of PCBs a day. Now, that amounts to less than 0.2 kilograms per year. So the estimate that the ATS identifies as somehow being counter to the government's position suggests that Neenah Foundry releases far less PCBs than the estimate that the government came up with. Lafarge, the settling party. What's the evidence? Well, there are transformer pads that are near that property. Not even on the Lafarge property, but they're nearby. And so, therefore, that's somehow evidence that Lafarge released more PCBs than 100 kilograms. I think what I'm trying to communicate to the court is, after all of these years, after all that has happened, The record contains virtually no information about these parties releasing PCBs. And at some point, proving a negative, which is what we, you know, to prove that there were no additional releases is a very difficult thing to do, other than to say we have a lot of information and we don't think that there's any other releases. And if we discover new information, we're going to reopen the case, which is precisely what the government has done here. That's a very reasonable way of moving forward. It's a way that conforms to the ample case law that suggests that the government needs to be able to settle these cases in light of incomplete information, and the statutory command that we resolve these cases, especially with respect to de minimis parties, who face substantial risk of being sort of, the district court said, bludgeoned into making more generous settlements to other private parties than really their share would justify. In those circumstances, the government has a duty to go out and make sure that these parties aren't being subjected to decades of litigation, even though they've released, they had one spill one time.
Would you agree that Judge Griesbach considered culpability significantly in that summary judgment ruling in the NCR contribution suit?
In the NCR contribution suit? I believe that's the case. Obviously, that appeal isn't here,
right.
But I think that's true.
And he refers to that ruling to sort of explain some of his reasons for accepting these consent settlements. Do you agree with that?
He does. He does.
And what about Mr. Freed's point that culpability is an improper consideration under 122G?
Two responses, Your Honor. First, I didn't read that objection as being in their brief, so I'm not sure that it's really properly before the court, and it may have been waived. But even to the extent that was preserved, first, the question here in terms of what factors are considered is what factors EPA considered and the government's considered. There's nothing in the record which suggests that EPA made its determination based on any sort of culpability determination. And the second point is, I don't think it's fair to say that 122 excludes consideration of culpability. What 122 suggests is, in order to identify a de minimis party, you consider the amount they released. But once you've identified a de minimis party based on the amount they released, the government does have the ability to consider equitable factors in assessing how much they're going to pay. And culpability might be a relevant factor in some case. I don't think the documentation here doesn't suggest that was a factor that was considered by EPA.
Can the court consider those kind of equitable considerations in assessing whether to accept a consent, et cetera?
I think in considering whether or not the amount is appropriate, it could. The district court notes that the government considered equitable factors in coming up with the amount of the settlement. And I think any equitable factor, Section 113F1 is written very broadly, and it's the only place that CERCLA talks about equitable factors in terms of what can be considered properly. So I don't think there's anything improper about culpability being one part of the calculation of the amount of a settlement once the criteria for 122G have been satisfied, such that the parties that are a party to the consent decree released only a very small portion of the total amount, and that the toxicity of their releases is not sort of disproportionate to what's going on. And with that, I think I'll turn to the issue of toxicity, which appellants suggested that the government just ignored somehow this very important issue of whether or not certain air chlorers are more toxic than the others. As our brief discusses, the science on this question is simply it's very inconclusive. Different PCBs and different air chlorers are toxic in different ways. There are certain congeners, which are the constituent parts of any particular air chlor, that are more toxic to certain kinds of species. There are certain kinds that are more toxic to other kinds of species. For a long time, the government has approached these kinds of cleanups with PCBs based on total PCBs, because all these PCBs are toxic, and it's very difficult to identify, well, 1242 is 5% less toxic than 1254, but more toxic than 1252, and that is something that the government's expertise and EPA's expertise in proceeding in that fashion is.
What's the scope of the district court and its discretion to choose between varying factual scenarios?
I think the district court's review is very limited, and the only question before the district court is whether or not the government is proceeding in a rational fashion. That's what the Canon's engineering case that Mr. Freed referred to suggests. So as long as the government can say, look, we've proceeded rationally here, that's what's required. And rationally, in light of
the kinds of parties that are before it, in light of the purposes of CERCLA, and particularly of the amendments to CERCLA to ensure early settlement, particularly for parties that bear very minimal costs. The other thing I wanted to mention to the court is that there was a lot. Mr. Fried suggested that the government has thwarted them at every turn in the contribution suit in particular, and I don't think that's an accurate representation of what's gone on. The government is a defendant there, though we really haven't been, we have not been a part of phase one, particularly, of that case. So the various orders that Mr. Fried was referring to are not orders that the government sponsored. We didn't ask the court to only consider culpability. We didn't ask the court to make sure that only certain kinds of discovery would be permitted. The court did issue orders to that effect, but it wasn't at our behest. It was at the behest of the other parties that were defendants in that case. And moreover, I think that this emphasis on the discovery elements of that case is somewhat misguided, because even though the district court did suggest, it did issue relatively narrow sort of avenues for discovery and suggest that that was all that was appropriate, the record that NCR provided to this court in this case shows that they went well beyond that in terms of their depositions. They asked about far-ranging issues in the depositions that they took of settling parties, in terms of where they used transformers, whether there were transformer spills, whether PCBs that had nothing to do with Aerochlor 1242 were being used, and had nothing to do with culpability. So I don't think that, to the extent the district court's order may have suggested limited discovery, there's no evidence that that's actually what happened. In fact, and nonetheless, there's been no additional evidence that's turned up about PCB releases that the government has not known about with respect to these parties. The other point I wanted to make, both Ms. Roach and Mr. Fried suggested that the government has conceded in its brief somehow that Aerochlors other than 1242 were released by these settling parties. I don't think you need to turn to the brief to find that. I mean, the response to comments that the agencies put together says, yeah, there may have been Aerochlors other than 1242 that were released by these settling parties, and we considered that. Our estimates are not estimates of the releases of Aerochlor 1242 by these parties. They're estimates of the total PCBs that were released by these parties. So whatever, it's simply factually unsupported to suggest that the government, in coming up with the estimates of this 100-kilogram estimate for these particular parties, only considered Aerochlor 1242. Now, we did only consider Aerochlor 1242 in coming up with the total amount of PCBs released into the Fox River. That's the denominator of this equation to determine liability. You have the numerator of the amount that these parties released, so the denominator is the total amount that's been released. And so we took a very conservative approach to the denominator by saying we're only going to consider what we know about Aerochlor 1242, so that'll make the denominator smaller. And if you look at the range of estimates of Aerochlor 1242, the estimates range anywhere from about 200,000 kilograms to over 1 million kilograms that have been released. And we took the lower of those numbers. We took the 230,000 kilogram number, making the denominator a small number, a conservative number, and thereby making the proportionate responsibility of these settling parties relatively larger. Now, it's unclear as to what possible benefit it could be to the appellants here for us to have increased the size of the denominator and thereby to have shrunk the proportionate liability of these settling parties, because they proffer no evidence that these parties have released more PCBs than the government estimated, with one exception. They did proffer evidence in their comments about Green Bay Municipal Sewerage District. And what happened? The government considered that evidence, and it increased the payments by that PRP. NCR estimated that PRP could be releasing, I think it was about 300 PCB pounds of PC, or kilograms of PCBs. The government said, you know, we actually think that the numbers that you are raising suggest a slightly lower release, but in an exercise of caution and based on uncertainty, we're going to increase the amount to 500 kilograms. So the government has demonstrated exactly how this reopener would work. When new information comes to light, the government takes that information very seriously, takes it into account, and reopens the consent decree, negotiates a higher consent decree, or if Green Bay Municipal Sewerage District had refused to increase their amount of payment, then they would have been out of the consent decree. The other thing I want to note to the government, to the court, in terms of the information that the government required, is I think it's very important to note that in negotiating these settlement decrees, these settlements, the government required each of the settlers to turn over any record documents they had with respect to PCB releases and certify that they have done so. So if this is a term of the consent decrees, and if, in fact, evidence came to light that one of the settlors had withheld a document, for instance, that would be in violation of the consent decree. And, you know, obviously, you would have to see what would happen at that point, but the consent decree requires them to have done that, and they would be in violation of one of its terms. Finally, I wanted to talk briefly about the Montrose case. It is the one case that appellants can identify, and the one case I'm aware of, where a court of appeals has ever reversed a district court's entry of a consent decree under CERCLA. But the circumstances in that case are wildly different than those here. In that case, by the time there was a magistrate judge proceeding, but by the time it got to the district court, the record included no estimate for the total amount of his natural resources damages that were at issue there. There was just nothing. It was, and so the district court basically had a suggestion that these parties were liable parties and they should pay X amount of money. And the Court of Appeals said, well, you need to have at least an estimate of the amount of total damages. So that, I mean, if the damages are $1 trillion and you're asking them to pay $100,000, well, that might sort of raise some alarm bells for us. If the total damages are $200,000 and they're paying $100,000, well, it seems pretty reasonable. You need to have some number in there. There needs to be some estimate. That information, the information that the Montrose court requested, is precisely what the government did here. It did provide the district court with these various estimates of the releases of PCBs from each of these parties, estimates of the total cost of the cleanup, with a considerable factor for uncertainty, and estimates of the total amount of PCBs that have been released, with, again, a considerable factor for uncertainty. So that's precisely what the Montrose court envisioned. And as a result, I don't think that case supports to any extent the argument that there should be a reversal in this case. Finally, the last thing I'll just touch on briefly is this question of divisibility. As we discussed in our brief, divisibility is an affirmative defense that parties can raise in response to a government suit. These defendants who ended up settling did not raise that affirmative defense, so there's no basis for the district court considering that issue here. NCR and Appleton, of course, have that the possibility of raising divisibility as an affirmative defense in the suit that the government has now filed or in some other proceeding. But divisibility is not an inchoate concept that applies site-wide. It's about a particular party and whether or not they can show the factual predicate necessary for a divisibility to occur. And as this court has noted, that's an exceptionally high burden, an exceptionally rare circumstance. When you have a circumstance here where parties are releasing things into a river, which, according to the ATS report itself, means they all get mixed around and you can't really trace any particular sample to any particular polluter, I think probably the burden on divisibility would be very challenging, but regardless, it's totally irrelevant to the case here where parties didn't raise it. Unless there are further questions. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Mr. Freed, are you doing any rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Rowe?
Mr. Padel started his argument by talking about the exhaustive and thorough investigation that was performed here, but the fact is a complete investigation into all the sources of PCBs was not, in fact, conducted. Although the EPA was looking at it, the EPA modified its methods so as to ignore detections of non-1242. Mr. Padel talks about the 104E information requests. Those were never served on five of the settling defendants. Mr. Padel also talked about, well, the information requests that were served on certain of the settling defendants did ask questions that went beyond, in certain cases, carbonless copy paper. And while that's true to a very limited extent, the government didn't follow up when there was information that came out in certain of the 104E request responses indicating that the settling defendants in fact discharged non-1242. I have limited time, so I won't quote it, but at record document number 60-1, at page 7, there's an example of DePere, one of the settling defendants, responding that it didn't accept wastewater containing other PCBs, but there's also evidence from a government memo, Tech Memo 2D, that DePere did discharge air floors 1248, 1254. The government never followed up to investigate because the government has throughout had tunnel vision on 1242. The government has argued that appellants have not been able to come forward with greater evidence of non-1242 than we did. It's not our burden in the first instance. It was the government's burden, and the government's estimate simply was never sustained with any evidence showing its work, and that estimate was simply accepted by the district court at face value, moving immediately to an improper factor instead, the culpability factor, which we did not waive. We argued in our brief that the district court was required to make its decision on the basis of the factors identified in the statute. That is not one of them. The CERCLA requires for de minimis consent decrees to be approved. They must be fair, reasonable, and consistent with the purposes of CERCLA. CERCLA's fundamental purpose is that the polluter should pay. These settling defendants, it is not at all clear from the record that the trivial amount that they are being required to pay by the de minimis consent decree, in fact, is proportional to the pollution that they caused. For all of these reasons, the agencies failed to give the district court proper information. The district court simply accepted it at face value, relied on improper factors. We would ask that the consent decrees be vacated and the judgment of the district court be reversed.
Thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.